Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Extra Serving, a restaurant industry podcast by The Last Bite Network, a product of Nation's Restaurant News and Restaurant Hospitality. I'm your host, Holly Petrie, here with the latest episode. Before we get into that, here's some news from The Last Bite Network that's been happening in the past few weeks. Be sure to check out the latest episode of Takeaway with Sam Okus, featuring Craig Dunaway, the president of Penn Station East Coast Subs, who offered his blueprint for navigating franchisees through the pandemic. Over on Restaurant Hospitality, Brett Thorne's latest episode of In the Kitchen featured Chris Chung, the chef and author of Damn Good Chinese Food, who spoke about dumplings, his Chinese heritage, and more. And now it's time to introduce my two co-hosts for this episode.
My name is Sam Okus, editor-in-chief of Nation's Restaurant News.
And I'm Brett Thorne, senior food and beverage editor of Nation's Restaurant News.
Welcome, Brett. It's your first episode back after the holidays.
True.
Should we ask Brett about resolutions? Are we going to ask him what he wants for? We've had discussion. We talked to Joanna last week about resolutions, and I also made it clear that I don't really have any. So Brett, you're up. 2022. What are we looking at?
There's no way Brett does resolutions.
Thank you. No, I don't do resolutions. Certainly not for New Year's. There are times when I think I'm going to make a change, and I make the change, and it happens kind of organically. And sometimes the change stick and sometimes they don't. But no, the whole I am opposed to doing special things for January, because I mean, when people make resolutions, they claim they're going to do it forever, but usually they don't last through the end of January.
Exactly. So,
and you know, there are things like Veganuary and Dry January, and
both of which I'm doing.
Good job, Holly, I guess.
Thank you.
But you're like, if you're going to be a vegan, be a vegan. Why are you doing it for a month? Like, what is your reasoning? I'm not asking you, Holly. You don't have to answer. I'm not putting you on the spot, but obviously you're welcome to. And as for Dry January, if you have issues with drinking, a month is not enough. And if you don't, then what's the problem? So a lot of that, I don't know. It doesn't really work for me. But I did. I joined a gym on the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah, which was, I didn't plan it that way. I just felt a need to join a gym, and I'm still going 5-6 days a week. So that's.
I co-sign all of that, because it is, if you want to do a change, do a change at some point in the year. You don't need to save it for January or whenever. But I would like to say, though, Holly, since we've started talking about this, I have come up with something of a resolution. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not totally void of goals this year. And this year's goal, and actually reminded me of it yesterday, we were talking about record players.
Yes.
And one of my goals for the year is actually to listen to more music. And this is going to be ironic, because I listen to too many podcasts. So listen, I don't want everybody listening to this podcast right now, like, to duck out and like stop listening to this podcast. But the point is, I actually found that I have listened too much to podcasts that I have pushed music out of my life. And so with a record player, it forces me to intentionally listen to music by putting on records. So there you go. There's my resolution for the year. And we'll check in at the end of the year and see how that's going, because I'm probably going to be listening to too many podcasts.
It's a good one.
Yeah, thanks.
It's good to take time to kind of turn off your brain, which probably you don't do when you're listening to podcasts. So,
right. Yes. You're right. You need some of that space to just like, you let your brain work and not be so engaged with content all the time, because it just like burns you out.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, Brett, our listeners have heard me say this a few times, but my resolution this year was just to make my bed. That was my only resolution this year. I never did it before. That was my only resolution. Nice and easy.
And it horrifies me.
My bed.
It horrifies me to think that she's not an adult yet by making her bed. But Brett, I don't know. Do you make your bed every day?
No, I'm looking at my bed right now and it's chaos. It's chaos. I do not.
So am I the weird one? Am I the weird one here that I make my bed every day and that's weird?
No, I think it's super normal for people to make their beds. And I think a lot of people make their beds and do other things like that to easily bring more order into their lives. And I think that's great if you want to do that.
Order,
there are a lot of things we can't control. We can definitely control whether a bed is made or not.
Actually, there you go.
Yeah, because you have the two kids who might, you know,
they often pull it apart right after I've made it. So
that kind of seems like it defeats the purpose. Why would you make it to begin with?
Well, yeah, it's true. And I get very frustrated at them when they do pull it apart and I just make it again, because honestly, this is going to sound kind of sick, but like, I almost am addicted to the productivity of it, that like by making my bed, I feel like I've been productive for the day. So if they mess it up, I'm just going to make it again. And it feels like I've checked something off the list again. And it's sort of like a little dopamine hit. I don't know. I think something's broken within me.
No, that seems actually pretty normal. I don't understand why I would make a bed when the next time I'm going to do anything in my bed, I'm going to unmake it. So I don't, but I think most people want more order and structure in their lives. And like, if you visited me in my apartment, I wouldn't let you in, but you would call the police because you would think it had been ransacked. People don't understand how I can live like this, and yet it's fine.
You're okay with it, that's all that matters. I feel like this is the point in the podcast where we should have a poll that's like, do you make your bed every day? I think we need to start doing some of those.
Well, Brett, you're in a studio, right?
Yes.
So you look at your bed every day?
Yeah.
While you're working?
Yes. It's right there. Wow.
My bed's right here. I can see my bed from my desk.
I cannot.
Hashtag remote work life.
I cannot see my bed from where I work, but I still like to make it now. From the past 20 days, I've been making it and I love it.
Stuck to the resolution. Good job.
Soothing. It's very soothing.
Should we talk about food?
Yes, I love Veganuary. That it's still food. Sam, it counts.
I think we need to come up with better names than Veganuary.
I completely agree. It's so terrible. It's a terrible name, but I love it. It's forced me to cook more at home. I will say that it's forced me to eat out less. I have been cooking a lot more, and I've been forced to use a lot more vegetables than I usually do. I've not been using tofu or anything like that. I've been just cooking a lot of vegetables. I've been cooking a lot of Brussels sprouts, which I never used to cook with. Lots of grains and sweet potatoes and lots of vegetables. And I've found all different ways to use them, and spices and roasting and boiling and steaming and sauteing. And I will say I've found a lot of different ways to cook, and it's been really enjoyable. And I will say that has been the greatest lesson from this month or this 20 days so far of being vegan versus the last time I was vegan, when I was not eating the same way. I was going out a lot, eating a lot of native foods, I will say. As my coworkers have heard before, I'm obsessed with native foods. Was eating there a lot, but now this time I'm cooking a lot. So I will say I will bring that with me once I stop being vegan on February 1st. But cooking a lot. And I will say I learned a lot more food pairings and a lot more vegetable pairings and grain pairings than I did before. So that's something I could take with me.
That's wonderful. And if Veganuary like moves you in that direction, great. My approach is that I too am cooking with more vegetables, but it's because I thought I should cook with some more vegetables. So I get out of the gym, I go to the local market, pick up vegetables, go home, cook it. Wonderful.
Is your neighbor banging on your wall, Brett?
There is some construction going on. But it's definitely my neighbor.
Okay. I was wondering if it was that, or if you were like doing a beat with your foot while you're talking, like if you were kind of drumming along.
No. I just have relatively thin walls in my building, and I don't know, like they've lived there for a long time. What kind of major construction do they need to do right now?
I would be so curious for a tour of your apartment one day, Brett. Oh my goodness. Of your ransacked apartment.
You know, 3 weeks warning, and I'll, you know, hire a crew and, you know, clean stuff up. I mean, it's sanitary. I wash my dishes. I clean my stove.
All right. Well, moving on from that and our lovely discussion, let's get into the news.
Let's do it.
All right.
Let's do it. I like the enthusiasm, guys. Let's do
it. As we shrug, we say, okay.
Let's do it.
Woo!
So This week, Starbucks, McDonald's, Chipotle all announced that they were going to be cutting hours due to staffing shortages. I mean, that's a pretty big deal. These are some of the biggest chains that are going to be cutting hours. This is some of the biggest news we've seen because of the great resignation. I mean, we're seeing this in real time play out in hours being cut, in stores closing. Now, it's not just that they're saying there's a labor shortage. We're seeing it play out with stores actually having to close. What do you guys think?
Well, this is a combination of the great resignation and the Omicron variant that, you know, is if you're vaccinated, isn't going to get you seriously sick, but it'll get you bedridden. And you can't go into work if you're bedridden. And if you test positive for COVID, you can't go to work. So a lot of it is people, I think, is people who want to work, but can't because they're physically unable to. And so it's two things that are compounded. I think we're probably lucky that consumers have, I think, gotten used to this and are taking it in their stride more than in the beginning when they would act monstrously toward restaurant workers.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like the Starbucks and McDonald's in announcing this, it sounds like they're cutting hours by about 10%, which is not hugely significant. And I'm not sure if they have said which hours they are cutting. But I have to imagine they're doing it very strategically to, you know, avoid the lunch and dinner rush. I mean, I think there is a way you can cut back on some hours without it impacting a big chunk of your consumers. Although I couldn't help but think about a company like McDonald's, which is, you know, if you think about McDonald's, like breakfast business, for example, and how it used to cut off at 10:30, I think it was, and how big a deal that was, how people care about like the hours with which they can come into your restaurant and access the food. For a company like that, you know, could have a big impact. For like Starbucks, if they're cutting hours toward the end of the day, how many people are walking into Starbucks later in the day? So it is to say that, you have to do what's necessary and you have to do this strategically so that you're not risking a big portion of your business. But my question is, and something we've talked about for a long time, but I just wonder, a theory we have put out there a lot is how much does this lead to automation? I mean, how much is Omicron and great resignation and everything else, it's just going to force the hand of these companies to invest in automation? Because, I mean, if you think about it, McDonald's, if they were to automate most of their restaurant, you know, you wouldn't have to cut hours because you could just rely on that automation to run the restaurant for you. So it just seems like it's going to really push the industry in that direction even more because of this.
Can we talk about PowerList or not yet? Because one of the
preview. We can preview.
One of the people I interviewed for PowerList, one of the people on the PowerList, Stratus Morfagan, is automating. He's opening franchising a bunch of automats of Brooklyn Dumpling Shop, which can be fully run by two or three people, contactless. It's a move forward. And as he pointed out, if you cut your payroll by a lot, you're actually saving jobs because you run a profitable business rather than a money losing business. So that although you're hiring fewer staff, you can pay them better and keep them more reliably.
Yeah, and you can actually give them benefits because you're paying them properly and you have the money to, while you're hiring less people, you're actually giving them the proper benefits, the proper money, you're treating them the way that proper staff should be treated rather than the way that staff is treated at a lot of restaurants, which is minimally.
Right.
Depending on the company. Right. Yeah. I mean, and I do think too, we're going to continue to see, each individual concept is going to have to figure out for themselves how much is hospitality an important piece of this business. I think Joanna mentioned this last week, but she's working on a piece right now. It is going to be in our February issue about this very question, which is to address the labor crisis, people are calling it conundrum, whatever you want to say, to address it, how much does you know, automation play into it? And then how much do you redeploy your, how do you just reevaluate your labor strategy generally? Because if you have a person working this piece of equipment that can be automated, what do you do with that person? Do you eliminate it? Do you the position, or do you move that person to another job? And so every concept, it's going to be a different answer for every different concept, because for some who want to protect the hospitality of it, like a Chick-fil-A is never going to just get rid of that position. They're going to put that person on the floor to go around and be friendly to your guests. But some concepts are going to be okay with eliminating the human piece of this altogether because hospitality was never at the core. So, in Brooklyn Dumpling Shop's case, Brett, I mean, you know, here's a concept that is accepting the fact that hospitality isn't going to be quite necessary, that people just want dumplings, delicious and quick and convenient and affordable. And that's the brand proposition. And so it'll be different for everybody. There's not going to be any right or wrong.
Well, also hospitality can mean a different thing based on what kind of transaction you want. I mean, hospitality, if you just want your takeout order, is order accuracy and speed. And that is hospitality. Or in the case of Shake Shack, which was founded by Danny Meyer, all about hospitality, another power lister, Steph So, who is their head of digital experience, was talking about how you make the digital experience fun. You become engaging and interactive with your customers, cute if it's appropriate to be cute, fun, responsive, and all of this can be done electronically, and maybe not quite yet automatically, but artificial intelligence is getting better and can get more engaging. But she also talked about how you can redeploy, to your point, Sam, people who would have been taking orders, now they can wipe down the tables, refill water glasses, get people drinks, and you know, talk like human beings to one another, which is something that any Danny Meyer concept thrives on.
Steph So, whose episode of the podcast will have been out by the time this episode's out, so you guys can go and listen to that on the Extra Serving feed.
Awesome.
But there's also places like Domino's who are doing AI delivery. So there's also places in the delivery field where you can completely take out the human being element. I mean, they're doing the autonomous delivery. That's really interesting with like the delivery robots. Then there's the pizza making robots where they're working behind the scenes, not even interacting with the humans. They're doing the cooking part. So there's all these different elements where you can work autonomously and find robots to do the jobs of humans, where they're not interacting with humans at all. They're not even doing the hospitality portion. They're doing the other portions of work. I mean, we have robots for everything, basically, and it's so interesting now, but it's also an element when you're a business owner of what do you pick to do, to use this for. I mean, it's you're losing something when you pick these robots to do something. You're losing an element of customization. If you are using a pizza robot versus a human, you're losing an element of hospitality. If you're using a robot and in place of a human when you are at the front of house, I mean, you're losing something. It's a trade-off. It's a money trade-off. It's a human versus personality versus, I mean, it's endless. I can't even imagine owning a business now. It boggles my mind. I don't know how people are doing it.
You also have to think about like what you gain, because I mean, I think you're right, Holly. I mean, you think about the things you lose. And I think for those of us who are probably more restaurant purists than a lot of people in the country, you know, it hurts your soul a little bit to think about what you lose, because you're like, but I love the experience. I love that, you know, I love having that same bartender or waitress that I see all the time and having a conversation with them. But to do another power list plug, you know, if thinking about somebody like Benson Tsai, who's on our power list this year, from Stellar Pizza in Los Angeles, you know, he's come up with this, pizza robot, robotic pizza truck. And you know, when I first saw that, I'm like, oh, novelty, you know, that's like, you're kind of showing off like, hoo-hoo, look at this robot who can make pizza. But what you gain is his big idea was not look at this fancy robot making pizza, but you can actually make more affordable, you know, make food more affordable and accessible to communities who don't have that option. And so it is interesting to think like there are trade-offs here, but if you push that, if you lose the hospitality, if you at least are pushing toward, but I'm fixing for something bigger, like I'm trying to solve for something else that does still make the community and industry better, then I think that that can be an acceptable trade-off. You know, if all you're doing is like, how do I make this more convenient and save money? Is it worth it? But if it is legitimately, how do I make this more affordable and I'm trying to do something better for my community, then maybe that's one filter to look at it as being like a better thing to do.
Well, and there are different occasions and different needs for different occasions. I'm a regular at two bars in my neighborhood, and I'm there really to hang out with the bartenders mostly and the customers. And obviously there, I want a human personal experience, or I would just, you know, stay at home alone and drink. But if it's lunch and I'm hungry, I just want to go out and grab something. I don't want to talk to anybody. I don't want to have a superficial, hi, how are you, chat. I just want my sandwich or whatever it is. And I think that there are a lot of occasions like that. And of course, other, you know, sitting down in a restaurant and people bring you stuff and they talk to you and explain, and it's wonderful and engaging. But it depends on the occasion.
It's interesting, this conversation. It's not quite the same, but it makes me think of two really interesting comparisons on our list, which is Alex Cantor of Next Bite and Kristen Barnett of Hungry House, who are both on our list. Next Bite, of course, is a very, very popular ghost kitchen company, and Hungry House is an anti-ghost kitchen. Next Bite's doing all these really interesting brands with celebrities and doing all of these really innovative brands. And Hungry House is doing all of these brands with chefs, and they're very chef driven. And they're both kind of coming up at the same time and going in kind of opposite directions. And one is taking a very celebrity and very like personality driven approach, and one is taking a very like small, intimate approach. And and it's very interesting to watch the two of them kind of simultaneously expand and be on our list together, as both being ghost kitchens, and to see the way that they're both growing together, but be so different in the way that they are explaining themselves, because they are so vastly different in the way that they are explaining how they operate as ghost kitchens, but also they're both ghost kitchens. They're both like, they are the same thing. It's kind of off topic, but I was, for some reason, this conversation made me think about the fact that those two ghost kitchens are on our list. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of automation. Ghost kitchens and automation kind of make me think of the same thing. I mean, Sam, you look like you're itching to say something.
Well, I was going to say, both of them advanced the industry in positive ways. You know, it's like, it is to say that you can have two things that are different and opposite, and yet both progressing, you know, the industry, both going in the right direction, I guess. You know, that's because I think what Kristen's doing at Hungry House, it seems like she's really trying to balance the sort of humanity of things and trying to protect like ghost kitchens as a viable option for chefs and their stories and, you know, everything that makes them a chef. And, you know, it's not to say that what Alex and Next Bite are doing is not that, but is just to say that that's a little bit more oriented around efficiencies and leveraging the resources you have in a kitchen to, you know, maximize your profit through, you know, having a virtual brand. And that too can be something where the independent mom and pop who's struggling to, you know, stay afloat right now can leverage that to keep them open. So there are just, you know, I think what you're, to your point, Holly, though, about how we have two kind of big things that are, you know, both kind of considered in the same sandbox here, but are in a way kind of opposite, but they're both, I think, good. They're both good for the industry and both, you know, innovative. And that's the beauty of the restaurant industry. It's like you can have two seemingly opposite ideas that are both moving the industry in the right direction.
And there's room for all of it.
Yeah.
There is room for all of it. And it's so great to see that there's room for all of it and all of it's successful. I mean, that's the best part of it, is that there is room for something that's a little bit more indie hospitality focused in the ghost kitchen world. And there's something that's that's more for the celebrity automation focused world, that you can have both of these be successful. Both of these can work. You have room for everything, and that there's something for everyone, and that it's not one consumer.
I don't mean to steal your thunder here, Holly, but should I segue this into Powerless just because it feels like it feels like a good place to do it? Is that okay?
Yes, go for it.
Okay, so go ahead. Yeah, Brett, you opened this, and there's no going back. So all of what we're talking about, obviously, we've been mentioning the Powerless, and we talked about it last week too. But we just published the Powerless yesterday. If you're listening to this, it might be a Friday. We published it on Wednesday. And the whole point of the Powerless, if you haven't already kind of understood it from what we've talked about so far, the big theme of it was big ideas. You know, in the past, NRN's Powerless has been genuinely who are the most powerful people in the industry. But we wanted to sort of flip the idea of power on its head and redefine that this year by saying that power is also influence, its potential and its ideas. And so that was the filter through which we named the 50 people on this year's list, which is to say, what are those big ideas moving the industry forward? And so we've shared a few of them, you know, Stratos Morfogan of Brooklyn Dumpling Shop with, you know, having the automat be kind of key to off-premises service. You know, Steph So in looking at the digital strategy at Shake Shack much differently and seeing how there are things that even customers don't see that impact the experience. Benson Tsai, who has these robotic pizza trucks out in LA, you know, all of these really cool, innovative ideas that I do think, again, going back to what we were talking about before, make this industry better. That was our filter through which we named these 50 people and published it yesterday, getting great response. So excited to put it out into the world. And so if we haven't already driven that point home yet, here it is to say, if you want to know 50 people, not necessarily names you will have recognized. And that's kind of the point, because we think these are 50 people who aren't just important for today, but they're important for tomorrow because of the big ideas they're bringing to the table.
And you can see it all at nrn.com/power-list, right?
There you go.
Yes. Yep. And for the next 6 weeks, we are dropping new episodes of the podcast that deal with the power list on Wednesdays. So you can catch those every Wednesday for the next 6 weeks. So be sure to check those out just on the Extra Serving feed. They're just going to be bonus episodes with our power listers. You're going to hear from people like Shake Shack and people from Pizza Hut and a lot of really interesting people on our power list. So be sure to tune in. And Brett, I'm going to turn it over to you. Why don't you tell us who we have on the podcast this week?
We have Susan Beard, the culinary operations manager for Slim Chickens, which is a rapidly growing chicken chain in Fayetteville, Arkansas, based in Fayetteville, Arkansas. They have grown already to like 151 units. And we talk about some of the new sandwiches that she's come up with. Obviously, sandwiches have been a huge traffic driver during the pandemic, and that has definitely been the case at Slim Chickens. They have a new Memphis-style barbecue chicken sandwich that sounds great. And she also obviously talks about the supply chain issues, and we have a good time bonding over our mutual dislike for boneless wings, that we just think it's a fake concept. Because they're not wings at all. They're nuggets.
And scandalous. Ooh, Brett, coming in hot with the opinion.
Yeah, I've done that before with boneless wings. Why are you calling them wings? You know, there is a chain, I don't remember which one, that launched cauliflower wings that are just breaded and fried cauliflower. There's nothing wing about it. Why are you calling it a wing? But I imagine that's because consumers now have come to understand that wings are a thing that you eat with your fingers and you dip in something. And that's
an American psyche problem, I think. Yeah.
And so, but if you already have tenders and you have actual wings, which Slim Chickens does, you don't need boneless wings. And this is something we discuss. And we had a great talk, and I bet you're going to enjoy listening to it.
Well, before I turn it over to your interview, Brett, I just want to wish Sam a happy early birthday on the podcast.
Oh, boy. Oh, thanks. I appreciate
that. Let everybody know.
T-minus 3 days.
Yes, you're finally old enough to run for president. So please don't leave us to do that.
2024.
Yes, please, please don't. So happy birthday to you. And now here is Brett and Susan Beard.
You are Susan Beard, the culinary operations manager of Slim Chickens, right?
Yes, sir.
And you're based in Fayetteville, Arkansas, is that right?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And so I was looking at our past reporting on you, and at one point you had 90 units, and then like a few months later, you guys had like 151 units. Like, you guys are so fast. How many do you have now?
I think the number you said is maybe right, like 150 or 151. I can't keep up.
You guys keep opening new ones every day, which is awesome. And you just recently came out with a new chicken sandwich.
Yes, sir. Right?
It is Memphis-style barbecue chicken sandwich.
Right.
Tell me all about it.
So it is a toasted brioche bun topped with some fresh dill pickles and a chicken breast that's shaken in a spicy barbecue sauce and topped with our crisp, creamy coleslaw. It's really delicious.
It sounds pretty good. Do you guys have a lot of sandwiches? I think of you as a tender and wing chain.
So we have four sandwiches on the menu. In 2021, we introduced our Kraft sandwiches to the menu. We had sandwiches before, but we wanted to kind of improve our sandwiches. And so we looked at a better bun and changing the dressings that we put on the sandwiches to make them travel better. And oddly, I was doing all that development in the middle of COVID. And so there was like cases and cases of bread coming to my house. And my husband was like, "What are you doing with all this bread?" And frying a lot of chicken on my back porch.
Well, that actually has to be handy to have a lot of bread when, you know, supermarkets are challenged and it's hard to get stuff. And instead, everybody's sending all this stuff to you. And obviously, you're going to have leftovers. You're not going to use all the bread. So,
of course not. Yeah.
So, hey, free bread.
Right.
A lot of corporate chefs obviously had to start getting everything shipped to their homes, and
of course,
you know, kind of weird. How did you adapt? Like, you fry a lot of stuff. Do you have fryers at home, or?
So I have a tabletop fryer that I keep at home, and, you know, for the days that we have to pivot.
Well, that's handy. And a backyard, so that's useful.
Yes.
You guys introduced the Kraft line of sandwiches last March, I think, right?
Is that early 2020? I believe that's right.
March of last year?
Yes, sir.
And so you got the Kraft Club, you got the Cayenne Ranch, Buffalo Ranch, and then a straight up crispy chicken sandwich, buttermilk marinated, pickle, ranch mayonnaise.
Yes, sir. Uh-huh.
And how are they doing? They're still on the menu?
They're doing very well. I think before the launch, our sandwiches were something of around 4 to 5% GOI, and now they're 12 to 20%, depending on location. I mean, they're selling very, very well.
That's great. And did that boost sales overall? I mean, I know you're the culinary, so I don't want to get all into sales.
Yeah.
So
I don't know if that was the only driver, but certainly those sandwiches travel a whole lot better than our previous sandwiches did. So, you know, with a lot of things shifting to online delivery and curbside pickup and drive-through, then, I mean, I think it made a difference. But I'm not sure of all the analytics.
No, because you're the culinary person. And those are made with fried chicken breast, right? And then you also use tenders for your tenders?
We don't use tenders on the sandwiches.
No, you use breasts.
Yes.
Uh-huh. But you sell tenders that are.
Yes, sir.
And you sell wings.
Yes.
And wings with the actual wings, and then quote unquote boneless wings that are breasts.
No, no boneless wings.
No boneless.
just tenders, bone-in wings, and then we use the tenders on our salads and our wraps as well. And we have some seasonal, like a mac and cheese bowl that we use tenders for too.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the mac and cheese bowls because those are fun. It's like mac and cheese with chicken tenders in them. And you also had one last fall with buffalo tenders, right?
Yes, with buffalo on the chicken and then cayenne ranch and fried onions and green onions and a little cheddar jack cheese on top.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah, they're pretty good.
So why don't you have boneless wings? I mean, I have kind of a gripe about boneless wings anyway, because it's a dumb name. Like they're tenders. Well, I guess
it's a nugget.
Right, it's a nugget.
Yeah, so a typical nugget's around 15 grams. A typical boneless wing is around 30 grams, but they're just nuggets that are different sizes.
And I guess since you have tenders, why bother?
Right. And you can get any of our tenders shaken in any of the sauces any of the wing sauces that we have. And so it seems kind of silly to have both, I guess.
Right. Right. And yeah. And if if I want a wing, I want to eat the wing and I want to have bone. Right. That's fun. A tender, like I can eat a tender or a boneless wing with my fingers if I feel like it anyway, probably does. And you have like 17 different sauces, right?
Yes.
What are the most popular? Like they like the typical buffalo barbecue, that kind of thing?
The most popular is ranch and honey mustard barbecue, cayenne ranch, buffalo. But ranch and cayenne ranch, I mean, are definitely the two top ones. And Slim Sauce is up there as well.
Which one?
Slim Sauce.
Slim Sauce. What's in that?
It's like a sweet and tangy kind of tomato-based sauce.
Barbecue saucy kind of stuff. No.
No. It's like, it has mayonnaise in it too. So, you know, it's more of like a creamy tomato-y sauce. It's a little sweet. It has a little bit of acidity to it. I mean,
a little like Thousand Island dressing, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, more in that range, but without all the pickle and celery and that stuff.
So what's your weirdest sauce?
Weirdest sauce? Maybe the sriracha garlic?
Yeah, that's, you know, not super weird, but your job isn't to be weird. Your job is to sell a whole bunch of chicken tender sandwiches and stuff.
I mean, we have Korean barbecue, mango habanero. I don't know that any of them are super weird, but Inferno is a unique one, I guess. It's a habanero hot sauce that's unique to us.
And on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the hottest, how hot is that?
It's probably a 7 or 8.
That's not nothing. Like, 7 or 8 is like, no, really, seriously. Are your customers getting increasingly interested in spicy food? Because it's a national trend, but you guys are more in the Southeast where people are already like into spicy food.
I haven't seen a huge uptick in spicy things, but to your point, I think, you know, our guests already have been interested in that since the beginning. So I don't think there's been a whole lot of shift in that. Maybe even if you look at a national GOI, it might even be a little bit less on the spicy things as we move more west and north and things like that.
Right, as you expand out of one of the country's spiciness strongholds, Southeast, and you got the Southwest is spicy, and then those of us elsewhere are a little bit more delicate. Although I grew up in Colorado with spicy food, so I'm into it, but I get, anytime I go to a restaurant in New York, they'll warn you of something spicy, even if it's like not spicy, like marinara sauce. They're like, oh, careful, it might be spicy, which it's not. But I guess
I've noticed that when I travel, if I go up north, that what is spicy is like maybe a 3 or 4 would be down here.
Have your customers taste, other than spiciness, have their taste changed very much? Either as you've expanded or as, you know, all of our lives have been shaken up and damaged by the pandemic?
I don't think we've seen a big shift in, you know, the product mix other than more sandwiches and, you know, more delivery and more less dine-in and stuff like that. I don't think the actual food that they order does change very much.
Just the fact that you rolled out better sandwiches, so people are into them. How about in terms of supply chain issues? You need to get a lot of tenders and wings. Has and you have to get more because you guys keep growing. So, and we all know that there are supply chain challenges. So how do you manage that?
I mean, I feel like some of that's getting a little bit better, but a few months ago, it was nearly every day one of the supply chain guys said, "Hey, chef, can you approve this sub for whatever item?" But I think we're always looking for new suppliers and ways to, with fresh chicken, you know, you can't have a supplier that's nationwide. Right. And so we're always just looking for that smaller vendor that can fit that kind of niche. And so we have a big distribution network of vendors at this point.
So regional vendors, if any of you are listening, you know, hit Susan up. Let me know. I can find a way to get you guys. What are some of the substitutions that you can reliably make? Because isn't a tender pretty much a tender, or are there specific specs that you have to focus on?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the non-negotiables, you know, like we can't sub a tender.
Yeah, instead of a tender, we're just going to use some back pieces, okay? Is that all right?
No. The things I'm getting asked about more are like, oh, we're out of this size straw, or we're out of, you know, I don't know.
Tangential ingredients, not like central. The tenders have to be the tenders. And are you in charge of making sure that, you know, of the supply chain stuff as well as
product development? No, I just work really closely with the supply chain guys. And, you know, I don't know. If they're out of this size of tomato, can we approve this other size of tomato or something like that? If it's a culinary thing, if it's going to affect the way something tastes, then I get involved. But
have you had to like rewrite the specs very much? Like, you know, instead of this item, if you have this item, then you use this item, that kind of thing?
No, I don't think so. We've sent out some communications for some temporary substitutions of how to handle it differently. But no, our supply chain guys are really excellent at what they do.
Supply chain topics are amazing to me. I've sat in on like supply chain meetings sometimes, and I have no idea what they're talking about. My eyes glaze over and they talk about things that I simply don't understand.
Yeah, I hear the word safety stock a lot. I don't know what they're talking about usually.
I want to go back to the mac and cheese bowls, which you launched in October. Was that the first time that you launched them, or is that sort of a rotating thing?
I think this is the third cycle for them, and they've been very popular. The guests would really like them to come on the menu. So I don't know if that will happen or not, but.
Well, why wouldn't they come on the menu? Is there, I mean, what gets in the way of
our menu is so big.
Yeah, that's fair. That's kind of a fall LTO that you guys do. Are there other LTOs we can expect coming up? You got the Memphis barbecue chicken sandwich now. What else is down the pike?
We have other LTOs coming this year. We usually do 4 to 5 promotional cycles, and we'll probably have something different for each one, but I don't think I'm allowed to tell what they are.
Don't give away any secrets, because I want you to keep your job. Because that's what a silly thing to lose your job over, telling me your secrets. Not necessary. Apart from the mac and cheese, what were some popular LTOs last year for you guys?
Let's see. And apart from the sandwiches.
Well, they're permanent, right? They're
Yeah. We tested them for a while in this market first.
In Fayetteville?
Yes, we did a salad with strawberries and feta cheese and candied pecans and cucumbers and a balsamic vinaigrette. That was pretty popular. We usually try to keep development to be sort of like line extensions, you know, maybe additional salads or additional sandwiches or maybe a different shake flavor. We have those mason jar desserts, and we rotate those flavors seasonally as well. So right now we have ones with cheesecake and Reese's Cup pieces and whipped topping, and then ones with cheesecake and Oreo and whipped topping. And then, but in the fall, we had ones with pumpkin pie and cheesecake and or pumpkin or pecan pie and cheesecake. So, you know, all the development's usually around not the core menu, but sort of line extensions of the peripheral things.
Well, and those seem cool because customers are like, oh, yeah, I like to have pumpkin pie in the fall. And also operationally, you just, you know, you don't put in Oreos or Reese's Pieces or peanut butter. Mm-hmm. You put in the pecan pie or the pumpkin pie. That seems easy enough.
Hard to make. We just finished up cranberry lemonade too, which that was really popular for a fall.
What is your development process? Like, do you start with like focus groups and like that, and then develop it like to test operationally and then in a market or two and then roll it out, or is it some other process?
You know, I'm on the marketing team and work closely with them as to kind of what they think the needs are to drive sales. And then once I come up with something that I think is worth showing, I'll show it to the product development team, and then it goes to the executive team. And then sometimes we'll test it in one store first, but usually we'll test it in a market and then roll it out to the system if it's successful.
And about how long will you test it in a market?
Usually 6 to 8 weeks.
So that's enough time to see if people are, you know, not just going to try it once, but come back and...
Yeah, and we'll do guest intercepts and send out, well, we haven't, during COVID, we've sent out guest surveys. Like, I'd love to get back to where we could actually physically talk to the guests, but we sent out guest surveys and operational surveys and, you know, just spend some time in the stores observing how things are going too.
So even in Fayetteville, you can't bring people in. Cause like here in New York, we're strict and, you know, you can't go anywhere if you don't have proof of vaccination.
But well, you can go dine in a restaurant, but I still think there would be some, it might be looked down upon to like approach a customer or a guest and ask them questions with an iPad. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think we're all the way to bride on that yet.
That's fair. You know, I respect a healthy caution when approaching global pandemics. Call me straight. So how long have you been with Slim Chicken, Susan?
A little over 4 years.
And what were you doing before that?
I was the executive chef of a large hotel and convention center in the area. And before that, worked in different, really full service restaurants. This is kind of my first foray into fast casual. I worked for Papado Seafood Kitchen in Houston.
Sorry, for which one?
Papado.
Oh, yeah.
Seafood Kitchen. And I worked for a lot of local restaurants here too before that.
So do you always wanted to be a chef?
No. I have a degree in biology, and I'd always kind of cooked on the side for fun, but I never really thought that would be my job. And I worked for the government restoring wetlands and realized quickly that I wasn't going to be able to feed myself doing that unless I went back and got my undergrad in bioengineering and then went and got a master's in bioengineering. And I just didn't want to go to that much school, and I went to culinary school instead.
A lot of school. Well, biology, does that help you as a chef? I mean, from a food safety perspective, it probably is really helpful.
You know, from a food safety perspective, it certainly does. And then kind of understanding a lot about the science of food, you know, especially for product development. It's helped me for sure.
Yeah, if something doesn't come out well, you might have an idea of why scientifically doesn't come out. But that's handy. And so then you went to culinary school and then you started working in restaurants. So why did you decide then to go into product development?
You know, I had been a fan of Slim Chickens for a long time. And when this position came open, I just thought it would be so neat to be able to come up with the recipes for Slim Chickens. I mean, we have probably been coming to Slim's ever since it opened. And, you know, that was one of the fun things about working at the hotel was that, you know, every day was different because you might have a group that wanted Indian food one day or a Mexican food the next day or whatever. So it's always coming up with new things and stuff. I've always loved designing new products and I never really thought that would be my full-time job, but it's certainly a lot of fun.
And it's a 9-to-5 job, right? More or less?
Yeah, well, probably 8-to-5, but yes.
And that's a nice change.
Yes, absolutely. It's a lot better for my kids and my husband, for sure.
Yeah, if you want to raise a family, you need very forgiving and understanding family members if you're going to be a traditional chef.
Yes.
Which maybe, I don't know, maybe that's a way to test a marriage and see if it's going to work, but maybe... Maybe not.
Yeah.
So you're having fun?
Absolutely. Yep. Great place to work. Great group of people here.
Oh, that's good. You plan on being there for a while? If you're looking for work, probably don't say it here. You know, that's
yeah. Lord willing, I'll be here for a while.
Excellent. Well, I hope so, and I hope that you continue to work for a chain that's growing and that you have continued success, and I'm looking forward to seeing what else is in the works this year. I'll be reporting on it.
Okay, great. Thanks, Brett.